kingsolomongrandlodge@kingsolomongrandlodge.fm.org or by calling the King Solomon Grand Lodge at 202-378-3843. A very heartfelt thank you goes out to all who contributed. We wish you a very happy holiday season and a prosperous new year. WPFW and our partners continue to positively impact the community one event at a time. On New Year's Day, beginning at 10 a.m.
Greetings. This is Brother Jamil, host of Yardbird Suites. During this season of lights, we ask that you remember WPFW and the sustenance we provide to the community. You can give the gift of WPFW from December 15th through December 31st during our year-end membership campaign. It is indeed your generosity that has allowed WPFW to provide news, music, and information to the people since 1977.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and you are tuned into WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
And I hope I am on. Dave Rabin, welcome to Community Watch and Comment for Tuesday, December 24th, Christmas Eve. I'm so happy to be with you. Coming up, we'll talk about a 60-year epic family drama unfolding at the Shakespeare Theater Company. But first, the mainstream press talks a lot about allegations regarding Trump's Secretary of Defense nominee Pete Hegseth's sexual abuse and excessive drinking. But little, if anything, is said about how steeped he is in Christian nationalism and increasingly powerful, undemocratic movement that has other adherents in the incoming Trump administration. That's putting it mildly. And joining us to talk about Christian nationalism and his political advocates is Professor Matthew Taylor, senior scholar at the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies in Baltimore, and author of The Violent Take It by Force, the Christian Movement That is Threatening Our Democracy. Dr. Taylor has an interesting perspective on the Christian nationalism movement. He came up in the evangelical Christian ministry, attended seminary, and then left to get a religious studies doctorate at Georgetown University. Dr. Matthew Taylor, welcome to Community Watch and Comment. It's great to have you.
Thank you for having me. It's lovely to be here.
Really appreciate it. So for folks that aren't initiated, informed, aware of this whole nationalism, Christian nationalism movement, talk about the title of your book, The Violent Take It by Force, the Christian Movement That is Threatening Our Democracy.
Yeah, so the title, The Violent Take It by Force, actually comes from the mouth of Jesus, Matthew chapter 11. Jesus is speaking about the impending death of his cousin, John the Baptist, who ran afoul of the Roman Empire and its proxies. And he gives this little reflection that has mystified Christians throughout the centuries, where he says, since the days of John the Baptist, which John the Baptist is still alive when he says it, so apparently that he's talking about his own time, the kingdom of heaven suffers violence and the violent take it by force. And Christians throughout the centuries have debated how to understand that verse. But my book is really about January 6th and about the Christian leaders who were instrumental in organizing and mobilizing and catalyzing Christians to be there on January 6th. And this verse was everywhere in their social media posts, in their podcasts, in their conversations. It was seen as a mandate for Christians to use violence, or to at least consider violence in order to put Donald Trump back in office there at the beginning of 2021, illegitimately in violation of our democracy. And that, I think, is the threat to our democracy that I'm talking about in the subtitle, is that we have many Christians in the U.S., not all Christians by any means, but many Christians in the U.S. have come to a place where they are prioritizing their understanding of what a righteous Christian nation should be over democracy, and are willing to throw away the rules of democracy in order to bring about their desired Christian state. And that is a real threat to the liberal order, to the very foundations of our society.
I mean, it's counterintuitive in a way, because you think of Jesus as being the gospel of peace, and yet it's being interpreted by, you know, certain of his followers as being a gospel of violence. I mean, how are they able to do that? And I guess I don't really have a handle on what Jesus was saying. Was he criticizing the impending, what, John the Baptist was executed, and was he criticizing the execution of his relative John the Baptist, or was he saying this is a good thing? I mean, it's hard to believe that Jesus was espousing violence.
Yeah, I also find it very hard to consider Jesus espousing violence, considering the other things that he said. And this is where this passage has been very controversial in really two millennia of Christian conversation about it. My understanding of what he's talking about there is that he is, and this is true really across the board, if you read the Gospels, is that Jesus is challenging and critiquing the Roman Empire and the way that it is attacking it. And I think it's anachronistic even to say attacking Christians at this point. He's talking about the way that the Roman Empire is attacking Jews. Jesus is Jewish. John the Baptist is Jewish. And John the Baptist has spoken out against some of the excesses and the abuses of the Roman Empire. And that is what gets him beheaded, probably just a few months after Jesus says this in Matthew chapter 11. And so I think what Jesus is trying to do there, at least my understanding, and I would say the mainstream Christian understanding, is Jesus is describing. He's not being prescriptive, he's being descriptive. He's saying part of what it means to follow God, part of what it means to abide by the values of the kingdom of God is that it will come into conflict with the kingdoms of this world, and there will be violence. The violence inflicted upon Christians and people who follow God and trust God, because that is the nature of empire. That's the nature of violent states, to inflict violence and try to enforce conformity. Now, the Christians who were using this in the lead up to January 6th, the way that they were talking about it was they believed that it is a mandate for them to do spiritual violence. In fact, widespread belief among the Christians who participated in January 6th, there was a very widespread belief that there was a demonic conspiracy that was stealing the election from Donald Trump. They believed that there was a human conspiracy as well, right? And there, I mean, one third of the country believes that the 2020 election was stolen. So this is not a truly fringe idea. This is something that is very, very widespread within our culture.
But repeat that again. One third of the country, the majority of Republicans, I believe, yeah, think the election in 2020 was stolen. I mean, it's extraordinary.
Yes, one third of the country lives in unreality, believes the propaganda, believes the conspiracy theories that the 2020 election was stolen. And among the Christians, among white evangelicals, it's closer to two-thirds believe that the 2020 right. election was stolen. And so religion, especially evangelical Christianity, has been a real amplifier of Donald Trump's election lies, and Christian media and Christian leaders have backed him in those lies. Not all of them, again, but a very wide swath of Christian leaders have supported his election lies. And the idea for those folks was they needed to show up on January 6th, use spiritual violence to take over, to defeat this demonic conspiracy, and to bring about the kingdom of heaven as they understood it in the form right. of a second Trump administration. And I'll just note that those same people who were despairing and frustrated and prone to violence at the end of 2020 and ready to take on these demonic conspiracies are jubilant today, because they believe that the kingdom of heaven is coming in the form of a second Trump administration now through the 2024 election.
You know, it's just so wild. I mean, because Trump is obviously a strange conveyor of this religious transformation. We'll get to that. But, you know, the charismatic Christian movement that you come out of talks about an ongoing spiritual battle between good and evil. But what you're saying is that this is a politicalization of it, that the Christian nationalist movement has taken it to another level and on the ground espousing and actually actualizing violence.
And that's the story I'm trying to tell in the book, is how did we get here? How do we get to this place where you have Christians literally believing that demons are affecting U.S. elections, and that there's this grand demonic conspiracy and that they need to do spiritual warfare in order to overcome it? I mean, throughout Christian history, Christians have believed in the reality of evil, have believed in the reality of demons and the reality of Satan, and have practiced ideas that we would today call spiritual warfare. But it's almost always been at a personal and a communal level, right? I've got my personal demons that I need to fight off, or my community feels afflicted by demons and we need to pray against those or perform exorcisms, right? All of that is fairly standard and mainstream in Christian history. The shift that has occurred really within the last 20, 30 years has been that you have more and more charismatic Christians. By charismatic, we mean kind of Christians who are kind of like Pentecostals, right? Christians who believe in the supernatural dimensions of Christianity and want to experience those supernatural dimensions. Those Christians have begun layering these ideas of spiritual warfare, of good versus evil, angels versus demons, God versus Satan, onto American politics, and saying that American politics is the battlefield for this spiritual warfare, and that there is good and evil in American politics. And this is just a very, very dangerous Manichaean way of approaching democracy. Because in a democracy, we're all human beings who are all in this society together. We're all trying to kind of build a society together, and we have rules built. This is what we talk about with democracy, is it's the set of rules that we have for adjudicating and working through our differences without violence. And the challenge right now is that many, many Christians have come to the point where they think that American politics is a battle between good and evil, and that they are on the side of good. And so anyone who opposes them must be evil. And they also would say Donald Trump is on the side of good. And so anyone who opposes Donald Trump must be evil. And this has led to extreme polarization and quite dramatic radicalization within wide swaths of the Christian community in the U.S.
Right. And it was actualized on January 6th. There was a large presence of Christian nationalists on the field at the Capitol, over 50. I think you said in your book that none of them were actually ended up being prosecuted. But I mean, it's a very bizarre, kind of strange constellation, a perfect storm, if you will, with Donald Trump, of all people, who I think, you know, no matter what you think, is a strange conveyor of Christian truth and actualization. I mean, it's really rather bizarre. But he sought them out. I want to move on, because we covered this when I interviewed you a couple of months ago. You know, he's a strange conveyor of this, but he purposefully sought out evangelicals way back, and he had an evangelical pastor early in this century that he later brought into the White House, a Miss Kane, as they say, you can't make this stuff up, but evangelicals love him, and he loves them. And he's the chosen one, anointed by God. And I should say, I would at this point be asking for callers, but we are in new studios. We made it so wonderful. Our extraordinary team got us transferred out of K Street to our new lodgings. It's really quite extraordinary. And kudos to everyone involved with that. But at the moment, we can't take callers. So I apologize for that. We are Community Watching Comment, and I want your comments, but today we can't do that. I'm hearing from my agent. What's that? I can take calls. Oh my goodness, we are up and running. Thank you, wonderful engineer Kalia. 202-588-0893. I would really Love to hear from folks. Please chime in, 202-588-0893. I think this is really an important subject. I want to jump ahead, or actually back, with our wonderful guest, Matthew Taylor. Trump in July, he was speaking to a group of conservative Christians, and he said, "Christians, get out and vote. Just this time, you won't have to do it anymore. 4 more years, you know what? It will be fixed. It will be fine. You won't have to vote anymore, my beautiful Christians." Matthew Taylor, what do you make of this? I mean, I'm kind of surprised that Kamala Harris didn't make more of this. I mean, it's really it's rather striking and frightening. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think we always need to keep our categories straight, because I think we often get stuck in American politics with being very self-referential and thinking that we need to make sense of American politics through American politics. we actually are part of a much bigger world, and there's a class of politicians that Donald Trump belongs to. They are called populist authoritarians, right? There are people who use appeals to populism, to kind of popular sentiment, to popular fears, popular angers, and then use that to come to power and then try to impose their own will using authoritarian measures. And that is true of Donald Trump. That is the style of politician he is. Those are the politicians he has styled himself after. People like Viktor Orban in Hungary, people like Vladimir Putin in Russia. And so the reality is, what populist authoritarians try to do is they try to take majority populations, inflame their fears and their angers, and gin up great hope for them, but also great anxiety, and then use that as leverage in order to win elections, to come to power, and then to try to take over the bureaucracy of government, to inflict retribution on their enemies, and to reward their friends. And that is the state that we are in right now. And for Trump, and this is very common with populist authoritarian leaders, they often find common cause with religious nationalist movements. It's true with Narendra Modi and the Hindu nationalists in India. It's true with the Christian nationalists in Hungary with Viktor Orban. And so what we are seeing right now is Trump has inflamed this kind of conservative Christian base around this sense of apocalyptic fear that Christianity in America is somehow threatened. I mean, almost two-thirds of the country is Christian. Christians are doing fine in the United States, but that many of them feel as though they are beleaguered, as though they need a champion like Trump. And then he also promises this sort of messianic hope. I will fix it. I will save you. In 4 years, you won't need to vote anymore, because I'll have saved and fixed everything, right? That's what's behind the rhetoric of that comment. And he made a lot of these types of promises to Christians over the course of the campaign, that we're going to end Christian persecution. Again, there is no widespread persecution of Christians in the United States. We are two-thirds of the population, right? But there's this way of using these styles of rhetoric, and this is very common around the world, to in order to keep this kind of angry base at a high boil. And that's the state we're coming into right now, that Christians feel both that they are persecuted in the United States and that they now have power and a free hand to push Donald Trump and have him protect them. And if that happens at the expense of democracy, then many of them are willing to go along with that.
But what does it mean? I mean, to go to the specifics, what does it mean? You won't have to vote anymore after this election that has already passed. He was speaking in July, the quote I just gave. What does it mean that he's talking about? What is his vision? He's talking about not having to vote anymore in 2028. I mean, he's annoyed at J.D. Vance. Are you not going to have an opportunity to vote for J.D. Vance? It'll all be fixed. We'll be past post-democracy. I mean, what is he talking about?
I mean, if you want to read it as generously as possible, which I'm not sure Donald Trump has earned in his political rhetoric, but if you want to read it as generously as possible, I think he was trying to say that he would have such a successful second term that he would solve all the problems that perturb Christians, and that they won't need to vote on these issues anymore. Now, I think that is being too generous by half. And I think that one of the common things with these populist authoritarians is that they, when they come to power, it through democratic means. We still live in a democracy. We had a perfectly valid election. When they come to power, they often want to achieve what is called authoritarian breakthrough, where they change enough of the institutions of the society that they and their party can remain in power. So I do not think it is a settled question that Donald Trump will not run in 2028. We've even heard people like Steve Bannon within the last couple of weeks start speaking about that Trump should be able to run again in 2028. And I also think that part of the playbook of populist authoritarians when they come to power, when they get into power, is they try to rig the system in order to keep their party in power. And there's a lot of different ways of doing that. It's not all gerrymandering. It's not all fiddling around with elections. It can be you start prosecuting your political opponents. You start going after anyone who would challenge your regime. And so I think we need to be concerned that a lot of things Trump was promising in this campaign, if he fulfills even a third of that, he will be changing the very nature of our democracy, moving us much more towards an authoritarian state, what political scientists call an illiberal democracy, a democracy in name only, where people do not have rights to freedom of speech and free expression. People do not have religious freedom across the board. And one of the things that is very common in these Christian national circles is they talk a lot about religious freedom, but often if you pay careful attention to what they're saying, they mean Christian privilege. They don't mean religious freedom for everyone. They mean freedom for Christians to do whatever they want, and everyone else has to conform to their will.
Yeah. I mean, it's really, it's somewhat subterranean, but very real, very frightening. Before we talk about Pete Hegseth, the nominee for Secretary of Defense, and other Christian nationalist adherents in the Trump sphere, let's look at some of the basic Christian nationalist priorities. One is religious freedom. I mean, they're challenging the whole basic tenet of the establishment cause, the separation of church and state, which was one of the foundations of creating this country. I mean, England had created the Anglican Church, the Church of England, and we were saying, Jefferson et al., we were saying, no, we're not going to have the state establishing a state religion. The Christian nationalist movement, of which many of Trump's adherents are a part of, are saying, no, there is, in fact, a Christian dominance that they espouse. If you could talk about that.
Yeah, in the First Amendment, there are two clauses with regard to religion. So the first is what's called the Establishment Clause. And establishment is just a fancy word for the officially recognized religion of a country. And so the Establishment Clause says that Congress does not have the power to establish any religion. That, in other words, there cannot be an official religion of the United States. That is in the First Amendment. But then the other clause says that Congress can also not infringe on people's right to freely exercise their religious identities, right? And so that has been, in many ways, the arrangement of American history that has allowed for great religious flourishing in the United States, right? There is not an official religion, but then there's space for all kinds of religious communities, all kinds of religious identities, and even non-religious identities to find expression in the public square. What we are seeing right now, and what one of the major ambitions of these Christian nationalist leaders and Christian nationalist activists is to really lean hard on moving closer to establishment, moving closer to where Christianity is officially recognized. That can happen through history curricula in school, teaching children that the United States is a Christian nation, and then trying to emphasize certain Christian themes throughout that history. That can happen through the funding of Christian schools, through the federal government or through state governments. That can happen through just the federal government itself privileging Christians. And in some of this talk about Christian persecution, and you'll note that they're not talking about Islamophobia and Christian persecution and Hindu phobia and anti-Semitism. It's only Christian persecution that they're talking about. So again, it's about protecting the privileges of the Christian majority and even advancing those privileges and using the tools and the levers of government in order to help Christians have more of a foothold in our society. And I say this as a Christian, I don't want that. I think that the separation of church and state is actually a wonderful arrangement, one that has allowed for the rich diversity and pluralism of our society. But there are many Christians who feel that that will be the way that they gain more power, is by having this more official sense of attachment between the Christian religion, and especially this very conservative, even at times retrograde understanding of Christianity that is the ideology that a lot of the people who surround Trump hold.
Right, and this goes to the whole Christian nationalist movement, that the country was established in a certain sense, even though you've got the establishment clause, no pun intended, but we are in fact a Christian nation. So it's a contradiction, but they're playing on it, and they're emphasizing the fact that we were in fact, there weren't a lot of Muslims and Jews involved in the establishment of the United States, if I'm not mistaken. And we are in fact, despite this separation of church and state, a Christian nation, and that in fact right now Christians are being persecuted, and we need to espouse and promote the fact that we are underneath the foundation of the country is in fact Christian.
And Dave, up until 1990, at least as far as we can tell from all the survey data that we have, about 90% or more of the country identified as Christian. Right. So when people said in the 1950s, oh, the U.S. is a Christian nation, that meant something pretty different than people saying it today mean. And so, as I said, right now, we've had this precipitous drop off in Christian identification in the aftermath of the Cold War. And we can try to theorize why that has happened, why we have this growing secularization in our society. But still, roughly 2/3 of the country identifies as Christian. But it's that drop off from 90% to the 65-66% has created a deep anxiety in many corners of the Christian population, this feeling that they are losing cultural power, that they are losing political power. And in many ways, you could read the entirety of Trump's political career as leveraging the anxieties of this vulnerable white majority. We are increasingly becoming a majority, non-majority country. We're becoming a country where no racial group has a majority. And we are becoming an increasingly religiously diverse society, including many people who don't participate in religion at all. And that the people who want to hold on to kind of a white establishment, a white privilege, and the people who want to hold on to a Christian privilege have banded together around Trump and see him as a warrior, an avatar who will hold on to their power and be a bulwark against this cultural change that we've been experiencing for the last 35, 40 years.
Right. I want to get to the particulars of the nominees, but we're talking in a broad sense about this whole Christian nationalist movement is pushing for the Bible to be taught in public schools. And this is not just theoretical. You've got it, in Louisiana, they're pushing the Ten Commandments. I think there's an effort in Texas, an effort in Oklahoma. You've got it happening there. And then you're talking about a very serious attempt on the part of this movement that's infused into the Trump administration of ending abortion. Let's leave it up to the states. That was kind of campaign rhetoric, but in fact, the states are many of the states, particularly in the South, are sanctioning bans or near bans on abortion, talking about blocking abortion drugs, talking about bringing back the Comstock Act, which would make it illegal to transport contraceptives and such across state lines. I mean, this is a very serious movement on the statewide level. If you could talk about that.
Yeah, and this is one of the big open questions about this incoming Trump administration. If you recall, during the campaign, Donald Trump dialed back his own rhetoric on abortion and tried to cast himself as more of a centrist, tried to present himself as being in favor of reproductive rights. At one point, he even adopted this kind of language that that Democrats tend to use about reproductive rights. But then at the same time, you had this Project 2025 document that was created by the Heritage Foundation, that was created by many people who were participants in the first Trump administration, many advisors of Donald Trump who helped contribute to this Project 2025, that advanced a very, very aggressive position against abortion. Now, one of the questions is whether they will try anything legislatively. I think it would be very hard to pass any anti-abortion legislation through Congress just because it's very narrowly divided right now. But there are a lot of other ways that the executive branch can regulate abortion. And so, as you mentioned, there's this Comstock Act, this Indecency Act from the 19th century that prohibits the mailing of indecent materials. And it would just change, it would just require some changes in definition at the federal level through the executive branch to say, hey, abortion drugs are a form of indecency, right? This is a really more of an anti-pornography piece of legislation from the late 19th century, but it could be reanimated and reactivated as a kind of anti-abortion legislation. This is something that's talked about widely on in the far right, especially. There's also this idea of blocking the abortion drugs themselves from FDA approval. And there have been Supreme Court fights over this, but more and more abortions are happening, are what we would call medication abortions, that are happening through the mail. And so there are many people, many anti-abortion activists who would love to block those drugs from even being able to be transported by the U.S. Postal Service. And that could really curtail people's access to abortion, even in some of the blue states.
Yeah, I would love to hear from callers. We have a little time, 202-588-0893. I think this is so important, extraordinarily pertinent issue. This kind of, you know, I'm not a big conspiracy buff, but this sure smells of a conspiracy. And I'd love to hear people chime in. 202-588-0893. I mean, we're talking about just, you know, access for a woman's right to choose is being seriously threatened. We're talking about, obviously, a threat to transgender rights. I mean, I was in North Carolina in the lead up to the election, and that was all the advertising on television was, you know, a fear-mongering around transgender rights. I mean, a very serious threat. Again, our number is 202-588-0893. If you want to chime in, I should say I'm speaking with Matthew Taylor, senior scholar at the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies in Baltimore, and author of The Violent Take It by Force, the Christian movement that is threatening our democracy. Let's go to the hot nominees that Trump has put forth, Pete Hegseth, very much a Christian nationalist. I believe he moved from the East Coast around, 2019 to Tennessee, primarily because he wanted his kids to be in Christian schools. Correct me if I'm wrong. He's probably going to defend himself against charges of excessive drinking and sexual abuse against women by saying, oh, I'm reformed. All of that did occur, but I'm a changed man. I'm born again, if you will. If you could talk about the Christian nationalism movement and Pete Hegseth.
Yeah, Pete Hegseth, I think many people are familiar with him as kind of a Fox News personality, weekend host. But he has a background in the military. He's a veteran. The scandals have kind of broken about his womanizing, multiple accusations of sexual assault, and the excessive drinking. And I think that is what has gotten a lot of the attention around him. But I think what is another very, very concerning thread around Pete Hegseth is his ties to far-right Christian nationalism. And he grew up Christian, and so it's a little bit strange to hear somebody who was raised evangelical say, oh, but now I'm born again, right? Like, actually, it seems like that was supposed to happen earlier before you had multiple affairs and had multiple children out of
well, he had two births, you know. I mean,
yes.
It's a little strange, but...
So he has taken a turn really within, as far as I can tell, the last few years into a very, very hard right version of American evangelicalism that's often built around a particular style of Calvinism, this kind of theological movement tracing back to John Calvin in the 16th century. And this group is called the Reconstructionists. This group of Calvinist theologians, and they believe in what they call theonomy, application of biblical law to modern societies, using the Bible to legislate and to govern and guide American lawmaking. This is part of their agenda, and this is the church he attends as part of this movement. These are the pastors he hangs out with, that he goes on podcasts with. These are his friends. These are his mentors. So he's moved into a very far right style, a militant style of Christianity, and part of the visual cues of that style of Christianity is an invocation, a frequent invocation of the idea of Christendom, this idea of the physical territory ruled over by Christian rulers, and also an endorsement of the Crusades. And Pete Hegseth has many tattoos on his body, but on his chest, he has what's called the Jerusalem Cross, which is a central cross with four crosses all around it. That was the symbol of the Crusader kingdom of Jerusalem when the Crusaders slaughtered Muslims and Jews and took over Jerusalem in the late 11th or late 12th century. And then you also had, he also has the phrase Deus Vult tattooed on his bicep. Deus Vult was the slogan of the Crusades. It means God wills it. And it's seen as, again, a mandate for violence. It's not that different from the violent take it by force, right? It's this idea, Deus Vult is a phrase that is saying God commands violence against Christians' enemies, right? And again, I would argue in complete antithesis to the teachings of Jesus, but this is a very strong thread in Christian history. And the Crusades are one of the most lamentable periods in Christian history, where Christians weaponized Christian theology and weaponized even the cross, a symbol of nonviolence, as a symbol for violence, and then went and killed Muslims viciously and unprovokedly killed Muslims and Jews in Europe and also in the Middle East. So it is this is a very concerning to see somebody who is going to be at the top of our military chain of command if he gets into office, espousing very, very far right Christian ideas and identities, and things that we would look at in the field that I work in of kind of religious extremism, and say he seems quite radicalized, right? He fits the definition of somebody who appears to be radicalized by the far right. I've never spoken to him, but all the symbols on his body, all the rhetoric he uses, he wrote a book titled American Crusade, where he's talking about these ideas of, hey, we don't need to be violent against Muslims yet, right? That's what he writes in his book. So he is espousing a very radical Christian ideology, and maybe the most far right Christian ideology I've ever seen in a cabinet secretary.
I mean, it's really wild, espousing this kind of ideology, and he has a drinking problem and he abuses women. I mean, it's quite a combo. We have a caller. I'm so pleased. I have a caller at our new location. Very exciting. Thank you for checking in. Your name, if you care to, where you're calling from, and your question or comment.
My name's Kelly, and I'm in Glen Burnie area. So I am a Christian, and I'm listening to all that you're saying. But I have to say, a big part of the frustration is, I carry a professional license, and I cannot say with confidence that I disagree almost with anyone anymore, because they've either become a protected class or it's just not politically correct for me to say it, or I could actually lose my license and my ability to make a living if I say that I don't believe that he And I think I share that with many, many Christians that have watched it go so far that we can't say anything about any kind of way out lifestyle or anything like that. But anyone else that doesn't, that's not a Christian, can take a stand.
I got you. We're running out of time. I so appreciate you chiming in. Matthew Taylor, your thoughts, please.
Yeah. So I hear what Kelly's saying, and I think there are a lot of Christians who feel this, that there is a sense that the culture has shifted in certain ways and that they feel that their values are not well represented in the public square. I will just observe that I don't know what field Kelly is in, but it does not sound like she is being licensed by the federal government. The First Amendment applies to the federal government. It does not apply to professional bodies that license you, right? And so the professional body that you belong to has every right to decide what its standards are and whether you conform to those standards. That is not a First Amendment question, right? The First Amendment is about the government restricting your speech. You have an entire freedom from the government's perspective to express your agreement or disagreement with people, to vote your will, to devote your values. All those things are perfectly protected. That is not a form of persecution. Now, it might get you in trouble professionally, but that is something to take up with the licensing board, right? Because the professionally, you chose to join that profession. You chose to get that license, and you are called to then abide by the standards of that profession. And you can choose to go to a different profession. That is also your freedom.
Yeah, it's very important. I really appreciate you calling in, and we are running out of time. Matthew Taylor, your thoughts about Hegseth and his perception of what's going on with Israel and Palestine, and how it relates to the Old Testament, to the Book of Revelation. If you could talk about that in the brief time we have.
Yeah, so Hegseth has expressed a lot of ideas that are connected with a strand of Christian theology that we would call Christian Zionism. This is Christians supporting the state of Israel for theological reasons, not necessarily for geopolitical reasons or international relations reasons, but because they have certain beliefs flowing out of their interpretation of the Bible that says that Israel is an important thing. And this is often tied to Christian theologies of the end times and what how the world is going to end and certain interpretations of the Book of Revelation. Pete Hegseth in 2018 was in Jerusalem and was speaking with some leaders in Jerusalem and was talking there about building the third temple. Now, for those who are not familiar with the geography and topography of Jerusalem, Jerusalem is a holy city for Jews and Christians and Muslims, and they all have traditions that intersect in that city, right? Jesus is executed in Jerusalem, the resurrection's in Jerusalem. It's the center of the biblical state of Israel, and it was a major center for Islam. And on the site of the second temple, the temple that was destroyed by the Romans in the year 70 CE, is the Dome of the Rock, the third holiest site in all of Islam. And so the idea that Christians or Jews are going to somehow destroy the Dome of the Rock, the third holiest site in Islam, and build another Jewish temple on that Temple Mount is that's a formula for World War III, right? And this is something that Pete Hegseth has just talked about openly, casually, as though like, hey, this is a possibility. This is something we should talk about. This is something we should think about. That does not signal to me the sobriety, for lack of a better term, of somebody that you would want being the Secretary of Defense who is helping shape our foreign policy. It would be a global disaster for somebody to try to bring about a third temple. This is an eschatological fantasy that many Christians and some Jews cherish, but it is not a matter of practical policymaking. And I do really worry that one of the agenda items of the Christian nationalist movement is moving the U.S. more and more towards what they would call unequivocal support for the state of Israel, and especially for the government of Bibi Netanyahu. And we've seen that there's been great violence and great harm done to many communities in the Middle East through some of these very aggressive policies on the state of Israel. And I think that it's not to say that there's not valid concerns on the part of the state of Israel for its own defense and all these sorts of things. But to have the U.S. just lock, stock, and two smoking barrels back anything that Bibi Netanyahu wants to do, I think would be a quite harmful scenario.
Yeah, I mean, and it's hard to imagine more support for Israel than we already have with the Biden administration, but, you know, it is possible, and we wait with bated breath to see what happens in terms of the Trump administration and Israel. Any thoughts about J.D. Vance? I mean, he had a recent, conversion to Catholicism, I think in 2019. If you could just touch briefly on that in the brief time that we have left, and I want to get just a minute or two on the nominee for ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee.
Yeah, J.D. Vance has evidently had a conversion experience, around 2019, I believe it was, to what we would call radical traditionalist Catholicism. So, again, a pretty far-right version of Catholicism, very very much in contradiction and criticism of a figure like Pope Francis, who tends to represent a kind of more centrist or progressive vision of Catholicism. The radical traditionalist Catholics want to have a sort of retrenched form of Catholicism that is much more built around a kind of medieval vision of Catholic theology as the centerpiece of society. And there are a lot of allies that he has in this, especially around the Supreme Court and some of the activists around the Supreme Court. And so that this is another part of this, right, is that the Christian nationalist movement is actually a bundle of different movements with different theologies. You have Catholics, you have Pentecostal and charismatic Christians, you have these Calvinist Christians, and they all are kind of operating in unison here. But there are some tensions amongst those groups. And Vance, though, has expressed quite extreme vision of Christianity in his own kind of podcast interviews and writing.
Yeah. And then in your elevator speech on Mike Huckabee, the nominee for ambassador to Israel, we have about a minute, if you could make it short and sweet, if you will. I mean, it's kind of all of that you're talking about on steroids.
Yeah, Mike Huckabee is also a participant in this idea of Christian Zionism, of Christians supporting Israel theologically. And my worry with somebody like him, he's one of the first, as far as I know, evangelical ambassadors to Israel. It's often a Jewish person who's made an ambassador to Israel for somewhat obvious reasons. But having an evangelical who has expressed, again, this kind of idea of unequivocal support for Israel, who has expressed doubt about even the existence of Palestinians, right? That there is a very radical vision for the state of Israel that I think Huckabee brings to this office, and that is quite worrying.
Yeah, it's so wonderful having you. I really appreciate your insights that you're listening to, as well as been speaking with Matthew Taylor, senior scholar at the Institute for Islamic Christian and Jewish Studies in Baltimore, author of The Violent Taken by Force, the Christian Movement That is Threatening Our Democracy. Matthew Taylor, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, David.
And on with our last important guest, playwright Tom Stoppard's Leopoldstadt, running now through December 29th at DC's Shakespeare Theater Company, tells the tale of a Jewish family's life and struggles over the course of nearly 60 years, beginning with their initial assimilation into Viennese culture, negotiating two world wars through to the aftermath of the Holocaust. We're joined now by the play's associate director, Dori Robinson. Ms. Robinson also understudies several roles in the play. Welcome to Community Watch and Comment. It's great having you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
It's really great having a theatrical end to the program after the the heavy subject that we just dealt with, you know. But of course, you know, we're not dealing with a comedy here. We're dealing with an extremely heavy, serious, dramatic, compelling play. The play Leopoldstadt starts at fin de siècle, I think is the correct term, 1900 Vienna, with a fully assimilated, well-to-do Jewish family. Vienna at its peak, at the height of the Habsburg Empire. If you could just talk about the initial opening of the play.
Absolutely. And as you said, it while it's not a comedy, it has a lot of comedic moments because Tom Stoppard does a beautiful job of bringing it to life and heightening all that life is. You know, you just said that theater, it's so great to end with theater because theater helps us process everything in our lives, from the funny to the difficult, from the beautiful to the grotesque. So the play spans from 1899 to 1955. It's an intermarried Jewish family who are both from proper Vienna and are very Viennese and a little bit of higher society, and also Jews that grew up in Galicia, which is Western Ukraine, Southeastern Poland, according to modern day. And like you said, this piece opens at a time of deep heightened culture in Austria, much of which was coming from Jews, the Jewish population, from Mahler to Freud. You know, it was a time of great invention and curiosity and creativity. And in fact, the play opens on Christmas, when they are trying to exchange thoughts, ideas, as well as presents. So you track this family from this big, huge, beautiful family all the way through these wars, and how one generation shifts and adapts. And you brought up the word assimilation, which is extremely interesting, because the big question that the illimitable director Carrie Perloff put out to us is always ask, who is my tribe? Who is my tribe? And part of the main character that we follow is Hermann. He's the patriarch of the family. He's the one that has converted to Catholicism, and to be able to stay with your family and to stay with your culture and your traditions, the way you think about the world, the way you move through the world, that is always what is up in the air as we move through the 20s, as we move through the 30s, as we move through the 50s, is how do we show up now fully as who we are in a world that doesn't seem to want us? And Carrie would often say that the Jews had the biggest unrequited love affair with Vienna, because it's just this rich, beautiful history, and it's so sophisticated and so smart. And time and again, throughout history, Jews have really struggled to fully flourish there despite their contributions.
Right. So you're telling this extraordinary history of the 6 years between 1900 and the 50s through this, you know, quasi assimilated Jewish family, you know, in Vienna, you know, where you've got someone like Gustav Mahler, a Jew who was only able to survive professionally because he converted to Catholicism.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
I mean, it's a very interesting way of telling the story. You've got this opening of high society, a well-to-do Jewish family, and then you've got in between the wars, you know, where, you know, there's serious challenges. And, you know, in Austria, I mean, Hitler was an Austrian, right? And then by the second act, I haven't seen the play yet, looking forward to it, but he's annexed Austria.
Yeah.
And
I
think it's just so important to tell these stories through, you know, different lens. It's not analytical. I mean, I just heard an extraordinary hour-long program, you know, telling the horror that's unfolding in Gaza through the lens of an 8-year-old who's living in Gaza. I mean, it's an extraordinarily powerful way of telling the story. And this play of telling the story of Europe in Austria and the horror of the Holocaust through the lens of this family.
Yeah, and to that point, I think it's really important that to know that it is theater, you know, the actors, portray all these different characters in all these different beautiful, sweeping, comedic, heartfelt moments. So it's not a documentary by any stretch. It's a family, and I think everyone can relate to family. So if you are interested, the play runs through December 29th, and you can find out more at shakespeare-theater.org.
Thank you so much for being with us. I've been speaking with Dori Robinson, Associate Director of the play, Liam Polestad at Shakespeare Theater Company. We are out. Thank you so much for being with us. Happy holidays. Take care.
Day, beginning at 10 a.m., the WPFW family and the members of King Solomon Grand Lodge will distribute to those in need all of the winter gear so generously donated by our listeners. Items such as coats, hats, socks, and more for men, women, and children are available. Support for our community begins at 10 a.m. from the Lodge, 2245 Rhode Island Avenue, Northeast. Additional information at WPFW.fm.org or by calling the King Solomon Grand Lodge at 202-378-3843. A very heartfelt thank you goes out to all who contributed. We wish you a very happy holiday season and a prosperous new year. WPFW and our partners continue to positively impact the community one event at a time.
New Year's Day on WPFW will be celebrated in sonic bliss as some of your favorite jazz programmers present the 2024 edition of New Year, New Jazz, our annual survey of the Jazz Year in Review on Wednesday, January 1st from 5 a.m. until midnight. 2024's favorite releases, tributes honoring artists who became ancestors this year, and music from favorite 2024 live jazz performances will be presented. That's Wednesday, January 1st, New Year, New Jazz, on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Greetings, this is Brother Jamil, host of Yardbird Sweets. During this season of lights, we ask that you remember WPFW and the sustenance we provide to the community. You can give the gift of WPFW from December 15th through December 31st during our year-end membership campaign. It is indeed your generosity that has allowed WPFW to provide news, music, and information to the people since 1977. Donations can be made anytime at WPFW.org or by calling 800-222-9739. We wish you truth and peace now and in the new year.